Doug Adler is with Raymond James out of East Lansing. We love having Doug on. He's the Senior Vice President of Investments. This guy, more than just about anyone I talk to about the market, knows what's going on. Doug, how are you?
Hey, Tony. Good morning.
Are you guys working today?
We're not. Bond markets and stock markets are closed.
Yeah, but you're doing something. I know you.
Oh, yeah.
You're digging around somewhere.
Yeah, try to get ahead, right?
Hey, before we start talking about the market itself, what's the market mean to the presidential race, whether it's a Republican, whether it's President Barack Obama? How does the market react to what's going on, and how could it dictate the race?
You know, in general, Tony, the year of an election, whether ultimately a Republican or Democrat's elected, the market tends to have an upward bias. And I think that probably has to do from two things. You know, one is the administration that's in control wants to spend to try to create economic activity, make people feel better about things. And then on the other flip side of that, those that are challenging, in this case a Republican, Republicans are kind of excited if they see their man or woman start to do better. So that kind of psychological boost that comes into the market tends to happen. So the data's pretty good either way. Ultimately, I think this time around, I think the market is definitely probably more interested in the outcome flipping hands this election to a Republican. And that's not to diminish the current president. It's just that he's, let's face it, he's a little bit more restrictive with respect to policies in terms of regulations, energy policy, tax policy, health care. I mean, there's a litany of things, and they're all big. And, people don't like change. Markets don't like change. And there's a lot of expensive change out there right now. So I think maybe that would be the bias. But, you know, the big thing and the most important thing at the end of the day, and I think thankfully for all of us, whatever your political affiliation is that the economy and companies are still bigger than the White House, meaning that companies are out there to try to get better, leaner, more profitable, et cetera. And we're seeing that. You know, the economy bottomed in June of 2009, and while it's not robust, there was a lot of damage done. The growth, you know, it's occurring right now. So things are happening, you know, with or without the politicians.
When I Googled, can the stock market be a good predictor for the president's reelection chances, there were stories in Florida Today and the Salt Lake Tribune which said yes. And in the Denver Post piece that I read, it said that the Dow Jones Industrial has soared 62% since President Barack Obama took office. What that got me thinking, if he's been somewhat restrictive, how did that happen?
That's my point. The system is bigger than the White House. I think that happened because we had dropped the S&P 500 by March of 2009. I guess the president gets inaugurated in January. It was a January 20th or 21st, something like that. Had bottomed at 600, ironically 666 points in March of 2009. And when you're that compressed today, Tony, the S&P is at 1360. So stocks, you know, a monkey could have walked into the White House and the stock market probably would have went up because it had gotten so cheap. To the president's credit, though, he came out and did things out of the gate, that I think from a psychological standpoint helped. But anytime the market gets incredibly cheap, again, I go back to, I really don't think at the end of the day, the direction of the market is going to be completely driven by what party's in the White House. It's the business cycle, and it happens. You know, about every 42 months we go into a recession on average. We were in one, obviously. It was awful. And then we came out of it in June of 2009. And when you're in the depth of a recession, if you look historically, stocks kind of get silly in terms of cheap. But that's the thing. Markets are really driven over shorter periods of time. Let's define that maybe as 12 months. As psychology, fear and greed of people, and that's really loosely tied to fundamentals. And we had gotten so depressed, like you do in any bear market, stocks usually slingshot out of that.
From your perspective, what does the market think about the Greek bailouts and what they're trying to do to cut what they spend, as well as what France and Italy and Portugal are trying to do?
Yeah, that's a tough thing. You know, clearly those countries have spent too much. I mean, this country has spent too much, and austerity measures are the call of the day. One of the problems with that, though, is when you start to constrict spending in a slow or contracting economy, it tends to exaggerate the negative, downdraft, if you will, of economic activity. So it's a problem. I'll tell you, the market, from a practical standpoint, you know, at least through my lens, is already priced in a default in Greece. If you look at the yields on Greek bonds, I mean, it's, you know, it appears to be over. So whatever the EU does, European Central Bank, all the politicians over there, at the end of the day, the market has already decided that it's over for Greek debt. I mean, it's just the way it looks right now. Something probably happens. There'll be some kind of settlement. But it's a mess, and that's a big risk for us here, ultimately. You mentioned some of the other countries. This rattles through Portugal or Ireland or, you know, ultimately to Spain or Italy. The dominoes start to tumble, Tony. And what I mean by that is now the pressure on the banks and governments, the stronger hands in Europe, start to really get hurt, through defaults or, you know, reductions in the principal, the workouts that they do. When they get paid back, they get less. And, you know, you model a $100 investment, it comes back through a government, add $100, and you only get $50 back. Well, you do that on billions, and if you rattle through all those countries, trillions, there's a hiccup there, and it's not a good one. So that's scary because ultimately, if it gets big enough, it would likely get into our banks as well.
Doug, we've had such challenges with the up and down of the of gas prices and what crude cost with the crisis over in Europe. But almost through 2 months of this of this year, it looks like the market's pretty happy.
You know, the exciting thing, I think, what may be going on is the market is really starting to appreciate what's been out there for some time. You know, you've heard things incessantly over the last few years that companies have all this cash and they're not spending it. Banks aren't lending. The consumer is upside down and they're not spending and all this stuff. And if you look at the data, Tony, it's rubbish. I'll give you just a couple stats. Last year, capital expenditures for S&P 500 companies was $1.2 trillion. Now, it's true they have record amounts of cash on their balance sheets, but it's also true that they spent more than they have ever spent last year on the business. So the money is being reinvested. The consumer's debt service ratio, which is just simply the money that's coming in and then what goes out, you know, the back door for debt service, that's at a 31-year low right now. So the consumer, you know, saw what was going on, saw the economy, you know, soft in 08 and then early into 09, you know, had to fix it, and they, you know, personally fix it. And you can see people having discussions, you know, at the breakfast table, husband and wife or, you know, whatever, deciding, hey, you know, we're spending too much, we're living beyond our means, we need to save more and spend less and reduce our debt. And they've done it. 1980 debt service level ratios today, and the banks have been lending growth. Their loan portfolio has grown, Tony, for 22 months in a row, and the annualized growth rate's about 10%. So if you get past the noise of Europe and the political rhetoric that's going on here in the United States, and you look at what's really going on, the system is, it's the economy, that's the system that I'm talking about, it's working. You know, it's grinding its through. The bar's been reset. Companies are doing the right stuff. And if you think about it, if they spent more than they've ever spent, which they did, and they have more cash on their balance sheets than they've ever had, that's pretty attractive. You know, if you're an investor, you're looking at that and you're saying, wow, record cash, that's good. It's like you and I put more money in the bank. We're worth more if we do that. Same with companies. And their interest rates as they pay on their debt are low because they've reissued debt just like people have refinanced their mortgages, and they've invested a ton into the business. And, you know, that's why you're seeing these corporate earnings have been so strong over the last several years. Companies, U.S. companies are world leaders in a lot of ways.
Doug, what's an IPO?
That's an initial public offering.
Tell me what you think of the Facebook IPO and what every investor needs to know before they buy into not only Facebook, but an IPO.
There's always a lot of risk in an IPO. Certainly not saying that Facebook's going to have risk, but they all have execution risk. The big thing that happens with a company like Facebook, there's initial public offerings going, going off all the time, meaning companies are being listed on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange all the time. The ones that get the fanfare are the companies like Facebook, and those tend to be what we call hot issues, which is to say the company issues X number of shares. Their offer price, let's say, is $30 a share. And the investment banks, these are the companies that help the stock get distributed across the marketplace. The investment banks, you know, will they'll pass along the stock to their clients. Typically, in a hot deal like this, it's going to go to endowments, pension funds, mutual funds, et cetera. So a lot of the folks listening right now are going to, you know, let's say if the stock goes up, they're going to benefit, but they're probably going to benefit indirectly because it's unlikely, unless you're a very wealthy investor, this is just how it works, you're not going to see the light of day on that stock before it goes public, meaning that you're not going to get any stock. So the stock, let's just say as an example, Tony, goes public at $30 a share. The very first trade, when it moves hands on the exchange, let's say it's 50. So if it goes up from 30, it's considered a hot issue. This stock has the, if you look at like LinkedIn, you know, a small comparison, but similar type business, what did LinkedIn do? The stock went, you know, ballistic to the upside, straight up. And Facebook's probably going to have that. Now, the problem is, if the company and the investment bank thinks it's only worth 30 and it trades up at 50 right out of the gate, then you might have a pretty expensive stock on your hands, meaning the valuation is too high. So that's the risk to the public, I think. If they chase the stock, they might chase it at too high of a price, and then down it comes. But you just never know. These things, again, I mentioned earlier, fundamentals are oftentimes loosely tied. It's fear and greed, and if people are greedy, I mean, the stock could get silly. Stocks can do that. They can go so far, so fast, you'd never really get a rational reason for it to happen, but they do, and that's just people clamoring to get in, or when we're in bear markets, people want to get out, and that's what happens.
Doug Adler is the Senior Vice President of Investments at Raymond James of East Lansing. Doug, thanks so much.
Tony, my pleasure. Have a great day.